All right, last week we started in Matthew 26, and we'll probably look more in Luke 22 about, you know, Jesus and the disciples are in Jerusalem for Passover, right? Passover was a one-day festival followed by the 7 days of unleavened bread, but by the time of the New Testament, often those two words were used interchangeably. So sometimes when they would say Passover, they meant the entire Passover and unleavened bread. Sometimes they meant just one. So that's what they are there for. And of course, there was a particular meal that they had, which has great significance. All right, let's first of all turn to Luke's account. Luke chapter 22. And we'll be going back and forth between Matthew and Luke, or Mark and Luke. Luke 22, verse 7. We'd already mentioned how Judas had planned to betray Jesus, how much he was going to get paid for that betrayal, and that ultimately, of course, Satan was behind it, but that Judas wasn't forced to betray Jesus. Satan tempts people, doesn't he? That's what he does. He doesn't force people to choose the wrong path, but he puts those opportunities for people to make wrong decisions out there. And that's what he did for Judas. He gave Judas an opportunity to betray Jesus. Judas then had a choice about what he was going to do. He could have chosen not to betray him, but he chose to betray him for those few pieces of silver. So that was last week.
Bobby.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Satan always seems to, when he's tempting us, pick up weakness to tempt us with. And
that's right.
That Judas's weakness was money.
That's right.
And he knew that would be the ultimate that would swing him over.
Yeah, that's right. He knew that, didn't he? Yes.
Judas was interested in money. He didn't realize what the end was going to be. He didn't realize that Christ was actually going to be put to death. But there again, it shows us what our decisions we make may have a lot more dire consequence than what we think.
Well,
it may not be a big decision at that particular time, but
that's right.
Down the road, it may be something really big.
And that's right.
In case it turned out to be something
really big. Lead to something really horrific. Absolutely. And you're right, it may seem not that big a deal, some of the decisions, but you know, in any choice we make that pushes us away from Christ and the right thing will lead to some bad consequences. Danny?
It also shows how our decisions can affect more than just us, too.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
People.
Yeah. Especially his. Boy, that affected an awful lot of people. All right. Luke 22, verse 7 begins the account of today, or for today. It says, then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. Okay, the Passover had to be sacrificed. And of course, this goes, you remember, all the way back to the Exodus, the time of the Exodus, and why it was to be observed. You know, God had told them about the sacrifice, and there was, of course, putting the blood over the doorway and all that that meant, and that he would pass over the ones who had followed what he had told them to do, and their firstborn would not be killed. Also, the whole nation of Israel was getting ready to exodus Egypt, weren't they? And so to do that, they were going to have to leave in a hurry. So the idea of the unleavened bread brings with it the idea that they had to leave in a hurry. There was no time for leavening to take place. So we have these two feasts put together, Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread, but they both have a lot to do with God's people leaving Egypt, you know, crossing the Red Sea, then heading on into the wilderness. So they had a great significance for them. This was something that they were to observe every year, and the meal that they were to prepare was, you know, there was a lamb that had to be roasted. Of course, it had to be killed, and then it had to be roasted, and then there were certain bitter herbs. And, of course, the bitter part of the herbs had significance, too, to the nation of Israel as they were leaving Egypt. So all of those things had significance to them. And so during all these generations, they were to observe that. Yes?
And this lamb is going to be crucified, and his blood is going to the spiritual side save us. I mean, so you see, it's no accident.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly.
That's right.
In the same way.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. Anybody wants to think, you know, that, well, this bunch of men just wrote this stuff down. There hadn't been a whole lot of research for a lot of people.
For centuries and centuries. Absolutely. That's right. That's a very good point, because, you know, who would have thought, what man would have thought back at the time of Moses, that all those things to do with the Passover and the lamb and the bitter herbs, the unleavened bread, would have had significance, you know, 2,500 years later, the birth of Christ and the death of Christ. See, a man by himself wouldn't have ever been able to think of that. Only someone who's kind of outside of time and able to look at the span of things and by his care and watchfulness, you know, orchestrate things so that they would work, you know, work out thousands of years later. You know, that's what, you know, Galatians talks about, that Jesus came in due time. It was the right time when Jesus came. Yes.
Just the association of being saved by blood.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, you just see that, you know, one of the greatest studies you can do is to see that whole plan of redemption as it unfolded during all of those centuries and how it all culminated there with the death of Christ and all of the significance associated with it. Again, you just can't put, you know, a few dozen men writing over all those centuries and have everything just perfectly work out. There's no way that was an accident. There was somebody behind all that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. When we've done things about maybe Christmas or whatever, my kids deal with religious things. It doesn't have to be a religious standpoint. I said historically, these are facts.
Yeah.
They can be documented and say, well, you believe in God or whatever. And I said, so separate apart from the Bible, these things, they still happen when you said it happened in the way.
That's right. That's right. That's a very good point. Because all those things were, you know, you can see them throughout history. And what happened, and like you said, where and when and all of that. So you have to really not want to see God's plan to not see it. I mean, you really have to, believe, you have to work at it to not see that. You really do. It takes a lot of effort. But if you don't want to believe in God and don't want to believe that there's an afterlife, then you'll go to those efforts to try and make all of that to be an accident, or, you know, you'll put forth that effort. Okay? Because it's your only option. Because if you don't believe in God and the Bible, you have no other choice. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very, very true. And it's interesting, and I'm sure you probably read about this. It was a little over a year ago or so. One of the kind of leading atheists for decades throughout the world, the one who had debates with Thomas Warren about the existence of God and so forth, and he was vehement about there not being a God. Well, he's turned around, and now he believes in God. And he was one of the greatest atheist for decades in the world, and debated people about it, and he was convinced there wasn't any God. Well, over time, he saw, and if you read about why he changed his mind, it's a great study to read some of his writings. This just happened, I don't know, the last couple of years or so, about why he made those changes. Why he now sees that there is a God, and why he believes that there is intelligence behind the world and all of that. It's a very interesting read. You don't see that happening very often, especially with someone as well known as he is. But it did happen. So it does on occasion. But it, you know, you have to humble yourself. You really do. You have to humble yourself. If you've believed this and been known throughout the world, you know, as a leading atheist, You have to really humble yourself to admit that you were wrong for 40 years or whatever. So that's a, you know, I admire him for doing that, because that had to take, that was a lot of courage to do, to admit that. No one wants to admit they're wrong anyway, but especially about something that you were so passionate about for so long, and then admit that you were just dead wrong that whole time. That's pretty tough. All right, so we've we're beginning of this festival. They're beginning to make these preparations. And Matthew's account. Let's go and just keep your place there at Luke 22 and turn back to Matthew 26 now. They all include one or two things that the other one doesn't, but Matthew 26, verse 17. Now on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying to him, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" They were all Jewish, right? So they were all to eat the Passover. So they go to Jesus and say, you know, we know it's the time of the Passover. We know the lamb has to be prepared and all these things. So where do you want us to start this preparation? So he says, verse 18, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.' So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover." Well, they, you know, I'd already mentioned some of the things that had to take place, and this was not something that you could do in 30 minutes. You know, this would take several hours to prepare this Passover meal. So, you know, it was a different time, and there was just a lot that had to be done. And it was very customary, especially at, you know, in Jerusalem during this time, for people, for Jewish people to open up their homes to other Jewish people who had traveled. Jesus may or may not have known this person, I don't know, but he said, there's going to be this man, and you go tell him, okay, it's, you know, the teacher, the master is ready to eat the Passover. And of course, that's what he was going to do, was he was going to say, yes, we'll do it. let's see. All right, in verse, let's see. I don't know if this is Luke's account or Mark's account. Let's see, in Luke 22. Let's see. Yeah, Luke 22, beginning in verse 10. Luke adds a couple of things that are, I think, are important to this account. "Behold, when you've entered the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house which he enters. Then you shall say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where's the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' Then he will show you a large furnished upper room. There make ready." So they went and found it just as he had said to them, and they prepared the Passover. So we talk about them being in the upper room, and there's a great deal that happens during this time that they're in the upper room. You know, we talked for months about what happened on that Tuesday. Well, we'll probably talk a couple of months about what happens in the upper room, because there is so much that happens, especially what John records over in John 14 through John 17. All of that happens in the upper room over a fairly short period of time. So there's a great deal that happens there. Some of what we're going to talk about today happens there in the upper room. Some religious people today say that you have to observe the Lord's Supper in an upper room. So there are religious groups that believe that location is critical. And we'll talk probably more about that in the next few weeks. But the difference between something that's incidental and something that's essential. But they believe the upper room is an essential. So that's what they've done. They're going to this upper room. That's where they're going to eat. The disciples find the guy just as Jesus said, and so they start to prepare the Passover. And in let's see, I keep going back and forth now. I think this is Matthew's account. Back to Matthew 26. of course, it's not Matthew. It must be Mark 14. I want to try and include all of these things and not miss any of them. We're going to skip the part about the betrayal. We're going to talk about that next week. I just want to talk about the Lord's Supper today. So in Matthew's account, verse 26, Matthew 26, 26, and in Luke it's 22, beginning in verse 15. Luke 22, and we'll start with verse 15, then we'll go back to Matthew 26. Back and forth and try and get all that is involved in the Lord's Supper. Then he said to them, talking about the 12 apostles, "With fervent desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer," because it's going to be the last Passover he ever eats with them. And he's going to institute a new type of Passover. He says, "For I say to you, I will no longer eat of it until it's fulfilled in the kingdom of God." Okay? That's very significant, as we'll see in the next few verses. Then he took the cup and gave thanks and said, "Take this and divide it among yourselves. For I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." Now remember, they're taking the Passover meal is there, but he's also going from the Passover meal to the what we commonly call the Lord's Supper. And those are two different things. The Passover meal had the physical lamb that had been roasted with the bitter herbs and so forth, and it was supposed to be fixed in a certain way, and there was a cup that they drank out of as well. And then in verse 19, and he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, he also took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you." All right, now let's go back to Matthew's account and see some of the additional things, or maybe that are worded a little different, and I especially want to point out a couple of things that I think are real significant. Matthew's account starts in Matthew 26, verse 26. "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed, and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom.'" What did Jesus do when he took the bread and he took the cup?
He gave thanks.
He gave thanks for it.
I want to ask a question now.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're not a member here. Anybody else have a...
It came up, and I never did satisfy the guy's question that he asked. But referring to, he always gave thanks before he broke the bread.
Mm-hmm.
We in the Church of Christ has a tendency to use three different plates up there, and we break the bread and put it in each plate and then give thanks for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so is it wrong to break it first? Was that his question, you mean?
His question was, he thought, and the elders handled it, that he thought that the bread should be there, and then they should give thanks, and then he should break it, put it in the three trays.
Hmm.
So I don't know. You know, you can strain a gnat and swallow a camel, you talked about. So I let the elders handle it. That's one good thing about it. I don't have to make any decisions. So
I guess my comment, first of all, would be every morning, or whenever we're partaking of it, and all across the world we're partaking of it at a different time, if it was important that it was broke before we gave thanks, then wouldn't everybody have to partake of it at the same time throughout the world? And wouldn't we have to start with one great big one? And then break it for all the different people? Yeah. Yes?
That's the same argument I've used with the one cup people.
You're right.
If it is the cup, it has to be the very same cup that Christ used back then, and you're going to have a lot of airplanes flying that one cup all over the world, so everybody can take it on the first day of the week.
But yeah.
The whole purpose of his cup here in verse 28 of Matthew 26, for this is my blood of the covenant. So the contents of the cup is what he's talking about, not the vessel of holy.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people at places would share the very same cup and pass it on. Sometimes the cup was a pitcher and they poured it into individual containers. They say, you know, we don't know how they actually, what they did at that point in time. And whether it's one piece of bread that's broken four times and put in four plates, or whether it's one little cup that's passed around, mm-hmm. you know, it's immaterial. What they stand for is what the importance is. And we in the church understand that.
Spiritual significance, yeah. Mitch, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, well, in Luke, it does specify more about the cup.
Yeah.
It says he took the cup, he blessed him, and he said, here, divide this amongst yourselves.
Yeah. Okay.
So the one cup then.
It'd be hard to cut that one cup several feet.
Yeah,
yes.
That's it.
Carl?
And another thing some people can say, it also says here, drink ye all of it.
Okay.
We have some left, are we supposed to go back up and drink the rest of it?
Okay. And that's the way in some translations it is too. And some people have said this.
This is all referred to, all the contents of the cup for all of you that's in this room. Right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And like, I don't remember now which one said, it's the, as he mentioned, the cup didn't represent his blood. The cup didn't represent his blood at all.
Well, I think what T.L. and Cheryl is so right that, you know, a lot of the people have put more emphasis on the container than the contents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this is what's happened with these people.
Yeah.
They put more emphasis on the container than the contents, and they need to stop and realize what they're having the prayer for, not the cup, but the contents.
Yeah, that's very true. Because sometimes we can, you know, we emphasize that container. Whether it's bread or for the fruit of the vine or whatever, but it's the actual bread itself, not that it's. And this was one of the things that I wanted to mention about the blessing. There isn't any special blessing on the bread. You know, sometimes, you know, some churches have taken it where that bread becomes almost miraculous, and the blood becomes miraculous. Well, God doesn't do anything miraculous to it. As we see in Luke's account, kind of explains Matthew, he gave thanks for it. That's what it's all about. It's being worth being thankful for. Yes.
Christ himself took the items, but took the special items, but spiritual significance to it.
Yep.
He took the bread and broke it and said, take, eat, this is my body.
Right.
So he himself took a physical item and put spiritual significance to it.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, see, yeah.
In Catholics, their emphasis is on the bread. Because those people stand in line and they give them a wafer, if they don't give them a cup to drink.
Right.
They eat the wafer and go their way, and the priest or whoever
drinks
the wine later, I guess.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know.
He drinks it up on the altar. He's drinking the wine.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, Dan.
We pass the bread in a container also.
Yeah, we do.
And
right.
It doesn't say anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. If the container was important, then since he didn't say there was a container, we shouldn't use one. We should just hand everybody a cracker and pass it out. That's why. See, I always sit up here first because I want the first one. Okay. If we were going to do that, just like if we all had to drink out of one cup.
Mm-hmm. That's what my mother's always said when she found herself in a one cup congregation. I don't want to
hear about that. So he makes a. Remember, he's just partaken of the Passover meal. And so the disciples, you know, they know the significance of the Passover meal going all the way back to Exodus and all that signified. And so now, you know, that's on their minds. They've just partaken of the Passover meal. Well, now he says this is the best time to institute a new meal because the Passover meal was going out of existence. It wasn't going to be valid anymore. So there's a new meal with new significance, and it's about what he was going to do here within a day or two. He's going to die on the cross.
Now, as you said, you had to prepare a lamb and cook it and all this, and that part of the Passover meal. Well, this one, it's just two items, my blood and my body.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And very simple. Very, very simple. We're talking crackers and grape juice. I mean, how much simpler could you get? So there wasn't anything real, there's nothing fancy about it, nothing complicated about it. It's simple. Yes?
And as you studied on Wednesday night, there's always an animal, almost always. I mean,
yep. Right.
Almost always it's an animal in the sacrifice.
Yes.
Well, those things ceased with Christ giving his life. So the animals had no more part of it.
That's right.
It was just these two items that carried over.
Yeah, so all of that, right, stopped, and he started something new. And they were to focus on, not how the bread tasted or the grape juice tasted. There was a spiritual significance, to it. And he comes right out and says, this is my body. Well, they weren't literally eating his flesh, like some try and say today. Because he was standing right next to them. They weren't eating him. But they were eating this unleavened bread, and it had a great deal of significance because he was going to, be dead in less than 48 hours or whatever. So it was, there was a great significance. That same way with the blood. He was going to shed blood. But that wine doesn't come, doesn't become literally his blood, again, because he was standing right in front of them. So he wasn't shedding his blood right in front of them. But that fruit of the vine did have significance to them. Because it was going to, every time they would partake of it, every time when they met on Sunday and they would partake of it, they were to go back to the cross. They were to go back and think about the blood that he shed, the pain he went through, the suffering, all because of their sins. And so the significance was not how much they drank or how big a piece of loaf they had. It was what was inside. Were they thinking about his sacrifice? Were they thinking about the blood that he shed, the suffering that he had to go through? That's what they were to do every Sunday. Yes?
What the faith is, if you get ready to take it and you have a thing against your brother, you're supposed to lay the stuff down. I mean, that would be immediately get up and walk out of the building, go find the brother if he's in the building.
That's right, and we'll be talking about that on Sunday night later on in the Sermon on the Mount, where he talks about that. A very important part of worship was what's on the inside again. What's on the inside and what they are thinking about and doing. Well, our time is about up this morning. There's still much to talk about with the Lord's Supper, so we'll be back in these verses again, Lord willing, next Sunday morning, talking about some more about the Lord's Supper and its significance. And thank you for all of your comments today.